All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 74 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're continuing with the story of the Civil War today. So where we left off was the South had seceded and formed a Confederate States of America, a kind of competing country with the United States, one that had a constitution all its own, and that constitution said slavery is a permanent part of our culture and we're never letting it go. So this proved to be very ironic. And I often find that the perspective that Southerners, many at least, still have about the Civil War is very ironic. By which I mean, they look upon the Civil War as being a terrible thing. They view it negatively because, in a sense, they lost. If you have a certain kind of cultural identification with the Confederacy, and you look on it negatively, which still to this day many Americans do, they look on it as being a bad thing. But the irony of it, in my mind, is that had the South not seceded, it's unlikely that slavery would have been ended. It's unlikely that their culture that they cherished would actually have been brought to an end. And it's quite possible that it would have continued in some way, shape, or form for quite a bit longer. And remember what it was that Abraham Lincoln said. He said, I hate slavery, and it ruins America's image, but more importantly, it really is a blot on America's integrity, but it ruins America's image abroad as a champion of freedom. I hate slavery, but there's nothing I can do about it. Because to end slavery requires a legal mechanism within the Republic, and, well, that remedy does not exist. There's no constitutional mechanism for doing it. And the irony here of the Civil War for the South is that by seceding, they created the mechanism. So that's the thing this is an irony that I enjoy. I don't know if you guys know what an ironic sense of humor is, but definitely the British and the French have a lot of ironic humor in their cultures that I enjoy, but the irony here is that the South wanted to maintain its slavery culture and seceded in order to do so, but that's exactly what led to its downfall. So irony is precisely when you get the opposite of what you intended. When your thinking is so flawed that you take an action which produces the opposite result that you want. And in fact, had you not done that, you would have been able to have what you wanted. This is a predicament. This is a problem that people who don't understand history and who act in ignorance of it and willful ignorance of history often suffer this consequence. They act, the results are the opposite of what they intend. It's really, really common. And the most common one I'm going to get off topic. We got to keep going. So I was tempted to go off on a tangent, but I'm not going to. Okay, so let's go into the actual Civil War and see what I mean by this. How it came to be that the Civil War led to the end of slavery. We'll kind of go through the story of the war and take us to that point where slavery starts to actually be brought to an end. So let me share my screen here. And I've got a few things to just kind of few different exhibits to bring to your attention. In the first one is just a kind of a postcard type illustration, not a great work of art or anything. I wish there was more great art about the Civil War, but it's actually pretty rare to find really great art about the Civil War. It tends to be kind of a lesser quality. And so I don't know how much of it we'll be able to do in history through art. But the reason why this one matters is in 1861, we have the first major battle between Americans. So we get this lead up to the war, and there's different kind of acts of violence that are conducted. But then finally, at a place called Bull Run, and I'll show you where that is on the map in just a second, you've got armies on two sides of a battlefield, and just until recently, they were all Americans. Now, you know, one side is declaring itself Confederate and saying, no, we are no longer brothers. But the truth is, just a few months earlier, they were all citizens of the same country, and they would again become such. But now they're going to kill each other. And this is the tragedy of the Civil War, and I think why it's so compelling to Americans to this day. Throughout America, you can find a lot of museums, of course, but in addition, you find a lot of people that participate in reenactment societies where they kind of have uniforms and old guns and swords and memorabilia from this era. And they get all dressed up and they reenact these battles. And it can be quite fun to watch. You don't have to live in an area that actually had Civil War battles to have Civil War reenactments. So sometimes people will do it in different places and no matter what. I think it's a lot of fun and just kind of a way to dramatize the moment. But, you know, we live nowadays, when I think back to this time, and I think about Americans today, one thing that really jumps out at me is that Americans are really out of touch with what war is today. And I think you can just kind of, you should be able to introspect this yourself. I highly doubt, but it's not impossible, but I highly doubt that anybody in the class right now has any intimate experience with war. If you do, I wouldn't mind if you're willing to share, you're welcome to do so. But I really, really doubt it. Americans are very disconnected from war today. And we're very disconnected, even though at this very moment, there are American troops somewhere shooting up with somebody. And we are living through an era that has been dubbed the War on Terror. But we're very, very disconnected from it. Partly because of modern technology, partly because of just how far away a lot of America's wars are because of globalization. But we're really, really disconnected. We don't really understand it. Not in that deeply, deeply personal way. And I think there's something wrong with that. It is something that bothers me. Because Americans don't take war seriously anymore. I think it's become kind of a video game experience I think that there will be a reckoning concerning that at some point culturally. The way that modern people are able to kind of pretend wars. I think it's very, very strange. And when I look back to the Civil War, it just gives me a little bit of a chill. It gives me a sense of this was a time when war was real. This was This was a time when Americans, when there were, you know, Americans killed each other, and Americans, you know, understood this in a really deeply impactful personal way. Imagine a war in your city. Try to, I mean, because you can't. Right? Unless you were in New York on 9/11, but you guys are too young. But try to imagine what it is. It's just, it's really shocking. So when the war started, it was a real shock. It was a real shock to Americans. They had never experienced anything like this. And the United States was not a country that had engaged in many wars. Very few people had any experience in war. And all of a sudden, tens of thousands of Americans were being called up into the militia and fighting on either side and had never fought before. And now they're murdering each other. It was a great shock. But there was no other way. I firmly believe that. People might argue this point, but I really see that there was no other way. Because as we talked about yesterday, had Abraham Lincoln simply acquiesced to the secession of the South, he was pronouncing a death sentence on the United States. He would have been the president that oversaw the beginning of the disintegration of the United States. And it's, imagine, right? If you're going to try to do that, imagine what the world would be like today. And I'll show you, like I promised, next Monday, I think I'll show you my map of the world today if America had not fought the Civil War. I think it's a catastrophe. And I think there's something deeply meaningful about that. That when people stand up to evil, it has powerful positive effects in the world. And the fact that America was brave enough to confront slavery and succeeded in its destruction was incalculably good for humanity. Even though it's a tragedy. Even though these people here, as we see them, are going to murder each other and it's going to be devastating to them, but they are doing something that's just absolutely critical, pardon me, to the shaping of the world that we live in. So how did it go and what is there to learn about the war? Well, I don't like to do too much military history, mostly because it's so complex and tends to devolve into like diagrams that are hard to understand. And it's just, again, it becomes kind of like that problem we had with the maps, where you're just learning details of things that have so little to do with the world around us. It's not to minimize or deny the value of, you know, the people who fought and gave their lives and all of that. That's certainly not my intention, right? But it's military history as such, where you're following the movements of the armies and the battles that were fought here and the strategy that was used by each general and so on. And it's very hard to connect up to the overall meaning of the story. And is mostly just really relevant to people who are actually in the military, who need to study that sort of thing. For us, I try to keep a big picture perspective. I just wanted to show you kind of the outlines of the war and what it was like, a few different features of it that matter the most. And of course, you know, what did it lead to in American culture is the most important thing. How did it shape the world that we live in ultimately is the most important thing. So as for the war itself, one thing that was really strange about it, if you can interpret this map here, right here we have Washington, the capital. And right here we have Richmond, And you can see a heck of a lot of battles around there. So a heck of a lot of battles in between the two cities. Does anybody know why this is such an interesting and significant part of the war? I mean, why would I bother to focus on this? What was there something special about Richmond? Keen?
Wasn't Richmond the capital of the CSA?
Richmond was the capital of the Confederacy, exactly. So it was like a special affront that the Confederates engaged in by putting their capital barely 100 miles away from Washington. Right? They're making this, you know, supposedly new country, and they're going to put their capital right here, right next to Washington. And so, not surprisingly, this is where most of the fighting happened, right within the confines of this map. And a lot of fighting happened in between the two capitals. This is actually where Bull Run is, right there, if you notice. Two battles of Bull Run. First Bull Run was the first major battle of the war, was right here. Look how close it is to Washington. Just, this is a railroad, and it's just heading right into Washington. And hard to imagine, but this is, you know, the battles were being fought. You could probably hear the cannon fire from Washington. So this is where a lot of the fighting was done. But not surprisingly, this area was kind of a stalemate because of the fighting going on here. There were huge armies, and they were mostly kind of defending either Washington or Richmond, and things were really defensive here in this particular area because you didn't want to make a mistake. You didn't want to be a general who would make a terrible mistake leaving the capital of your country, you know, susceptible to attack by your enemy. So there wasn't a heck of a lot of initiative and special kind of leadership that was shown, more kind of aggressive military action in this area. It was just kind of, it was pretty bogged down. It was because both sides really kind of wanted to defend their capital. And it was hard for them to commit enough and aggressively enough to seriously attack the other side. So as it turns out, the most pivotal events of the war occurred elsewhere. Now, there were really crucial battles here, but most of the critical events in the war occurred elsewhere. And so if we zoom out from where we are now and go to this map, we can see where the most important or historically pivotal battles occurred in the war. So here we got Washington and Richmond up at the top, right? And so this is where all that major fighting is going on in between the two capitals. But meantime, what we see here described with all these arrows and everything is what I think of as the most important progression of events in the war. So we have a bunch of symbols that we need to be clear on in order to interpret this and make sense of this kind of broadly speaking, right? So we've got the dashed lines, which are the borders of the states. That hopefully is obvious. We have the light blue squiggly lines, which matter in certain cases especially, which are what? As opposed to, be careful, the deep blue arrows. Don't confuse the two. The light blue squiggly lines are, Alexander?
Major rivers.
Major rivers, okay, good. And then we have the gray lines with the cross hatching, which are going to prove to be super important here. Timothy?
I think they're either railroads or telegraph lines.
Mm-hmm. Railroads, and we'll see why. Yeah, I mean, communication certainly matters, but transportation, in a sense, matter even more. So, yeah, that's why they're labeled on this particular map. And then we have the blue arrows and the red arrows. The red arrows are the major thrusts of the Confederate forces, and then the blue arrows are the major thrusts of the Union Army, the Northern armies. and or navies. And so what we're going to see here is that starting in about 1862, the Union started to be able to surround the South. One of the things that was crucial to being able to do that was naval power. And this is kind of a neat part of the Civil War. And remember how I was saying the other day, Alexander, you wanted to say something or ask something? Well, I can't unmute you. Unmute yourself, okay? If you have something to say.
What are the dashed lines? Because most of the lines are solid, but some of them are dashed.
No, the dashed lines are state boundaries. Back here?
No, I mean like the dashed movement lines. Yeah. Like
oh, those are retreats. Okay. Those are retreats. Okay. So this is an advance and this is a retreat. So this is movement forward and this is moving backwards.
Okay.
Okay? Yeah. All right. So anyway, going back to this, I wanted to mention, because we've got down here, we've got these arrows here, which are kind of interesting. These are Union forces, but notice what they're doing. They're coming in from the sea, right? And in this case, Farragut is moving up the Mississippi River. And part of what made that possible was the fact that the Union had more naval power than the Confederacy. And it was an interesting thing. I mean, I'm not an expert on these matters, but one of the things that had happened in the Civil War, which was very important, was the development of new military technologies. And partly contributed to America becoming, you know, a militarily competent and powerful country was the experience and the technological development that came from fighting the Civil War. And here we have these ships. Here back in the background we have the old style, you know, sailing ship. And in the foreground we have these new iron vessels. Almost like submarines, whose hulls were virtually impenetrable to conventional cannon fire, and so we start to see the development of these new forms of technology, weapons technology, and America is going to be one of the countries that starts to become kind of a leader in this particular area. In part because of the innovations that are required in order to fight the Civil War. And Alexander insists that there's a blimp in the background. Is this what you're thinking is a blimp, Alexander? Yeah, there was the use of military technology, of balloons, and there were the use of balloons and different things. So I'm not sure if that's a cloud or just a blimp. You might be just making a lucky identification. Yeah, so there are all kinds of interesting things in technology-wise to learn about the Civil War. But as far as the effects concerned kind of on the outcome of the war, the ability of the North to maintain a blockade around the South, a naval blockade around the South, was very important. And then to be able to use its navy in order to take over the Mississippi and to converge from the North and the South and start to gradually take control of the different railroad hubs became kind of the crucial element, military element of the story. And so these are the major railroads that are illustrated here, right? And now if you want, remember, right, all the fighting is, the most important battles are up here. They're between Richmond and Washington. Okay. But if you're in Richmond, or Petersburg, or Lynchburg, or any of those areas up there, of course, what matters to you is being able to get supplies from the rest of the Confederacy. And so you're going to either do that by sea, but if there's a naval blockade, and this is where the Monitor and the Merrimack are fighting it out, because the Union is trying to maintain a naval blockade up here in Virginia, right? Prevent supplies from getting in by sea. Meantime, you need to get supplies by land, and the railroad network that was starting to crop up in the United States is the most crucial thing. So in the South, you have two generals, one named Grant and one named Sherman, who were working together on on basically destroying the infrastructure of the South. And that proved to be the most important thing among, well, one of two really crucial things that they did. And so you can see these blue lines where they're going to different places. Vicksburg, for instance, is a crucial place on the Mississippi River and also a railroad hub. Corinth here up in Mississippi, one of the main thrusts of their early efforts. And Memphis were again, railroad hubs. And once you take over a railroad hub, and then Chattanooga over here in 1863 was a really crucial one as well. Every time you take over a railroad hub, you basically disrupt an entire transportation network. Right? You're preventing supplies from moving through that entire network. And especially, of course, if this is one of your lifelines, right here, leading to, ultimately, to Richmond. Right? This is an artery. This is where the blood is flowing and bringing all the supplies to keep that army alive. So while everything was kind of a stalemate up in here, what was going on down here was going to change the entire war. So now before we get to that, because just timing-wise, let's just keep going with this, the military side, and we'll track back to the significance of it all in just a second. So, apart from these railroad hubs, the most crucial thing that happened after Chattanooga, which is right here, Ulysses S. Grant, the General Grant, was sent to the north to handle this part of the battle, and General Sherman was put in charge of the army down here. And we see this particular progression of events that changed basically the war. What General Sherman did was, well, what he identified, what he understood clearly, was that Atlanta was the industrial heart of the South. It was the most important city in the Confederacy. I mean, Richmond was the capital, but Atlanta was definitely the most important city, the industrial center of it. And so he reasoned that in order to bring this war to an end, that was the most crucial objective. To destroy Atlanta was going to do a number of things at once that were absolutely necessary to winning the war. Number one, it's going to destroy the industrial capacity of the South. So the munitions, the supplies, even clothing, cotton industry was centered in Atlanta. All of the stuff, the materials of war that were being transmitted up to the army in Richmond, a lot of it flowed through there or was made there. So by destroying that, he was going to destroy the most important engine of productivity and of supplies for the South. But there was something else involved. Something else that Sherman was acutely aware of in the conduct of war. Which again speaks to how we are kind of disconnected from war today. What Sherman realized was, if you attack a place like Atlanta, what does that do other than denying supplies and materials of war to the army up in the north? You've got the army up here, you've got soldiers, and they need bullets, and they need boots, and they need coats, and they need food. Okay, but what else do they need? What else is absolutely crucial to an army and keeps an army going? If you're a man and you're fighting up there, what are you fighting for? Why fight, Alexander?
Because once you're done, everything is probably going to be good. Your side is winning, and you can go back to living in peace.
Okay, so you can go back to living, and living with whom and for what, Bria?
Your family, you're saving your family. You're the hero. If you come back and you survive...
Okay, you're coming back to your family, to your wife and to your children, and where are they? Where are they? They're not with you at the front. They live in these cities and on these farms and in these plantations and so on throughout the South. This is the civilian heart of the Confederacy. And if you burn down the city of Atlanta, what do you do to the men up here who are fighting? Bria? Right. I mean, what kind of effect does that have on their morale? Right? Because what are you fighting for? You're fighting for your way of life and for your family. And if you're sitting there defending Richmond, but you know that your family's back in Atlanta or your family's in Savannah and they're next, and Sherman is here with his army and he is bombarding the city and he is going to destroy it and burn down your house. What is your state of mind back here in Richmond? Right? It's really disruptive, really hard for you to maintain your motivation to fight, your will to fight, if you know that your family is destitute or their lives are in danger. You want to rush back. You want to be there for them. It's hard to be up in the north. And besides, what are you fighting for? Because your homes are being ravaged and your whole, the countryside and the life that you want to come back to is not going to be there. So Sherman's approach was very effective. People describe this type of technique as total war. Not quite, in the sense that Sherman was not a barbarian. He did not allow his troops to deliberately harm or target women and children. He warned the people of Atlanta that he was going to destroy the city, and he let them leave. Told them to get out and gave them enough time to get out and said, I'm going to ruin this place. I'm going to burn it to the ground. Get out. And he drove people away. But amazingly, people actually huddled around his army as it moved through the South, hoping to get scraps and hoping that they would survive in that particular way. He wasn't a total barbarian. He was a practitioner of the art of total war, but his reasoning was very straightforward. War is war. It's not a game. These people living in the South are sending supplies and baking cakes and sending them to the troops up in Richmond. And what are those troops doing? They're killing Americans. So there's nobody, if you want to fight a war, you can't pretend that you're not a part of it just because you're a civilian living in your comfortable home deep in the South and you're all apart from the war. So Sherman's theory is you've got to destroy your enemy's will to fight. That's the concept. And he did it. He did it, absolutely. By the time he was done with the South, there was really little left of the morale of armies in the North, and it was just a formality as to how the war would finally come to an end. Ultimately, General Grant, who was the other general that had been so busy in the western part and been called up to the North, was able to track down the commander of the Southern forces, General Lee, and they agreed to the surrender of the South. So, what did it all mean? Right? Because all the battles and everything, the only reason to know about them and to think about their significance and to be interested in them is, what does it all add up to? know that in part it's the crucial meaning of it is the eradication of slavery. So how did the war lead to that? I think is a really important question. Even if you're going to forget all the details of the war, and even if you're going to forget all the battles and never go see a reenactment in your whole life, what do you need to know about the Civil War? Well, you do need to know that the South secession was the crucial step that made it possible for America to get rid of slavery. It's a very ironic result. And it was during the war that President Lincoln finally took the step that was made possible by secession and not possible otherwise to begin the eradication of slavery. In 1863, he did something which in most contexts up to that point in American government was illegal. In only very, very limited cases could a president do such a thing as he ended up doing in 1863, which was issuing an executive proclamation, an executive order. Normally in the United States, the president does not get to make laws. The making of laws is done by Congress, by the House of Representatives, and by the Senate. And we already know that there was only one legal way within the framework of the Constitution for slavery to be eradicated. What was that process called? Making changes to the Constitution. What's that called? Alexander?
Making
a constitutional amendment, which requires what?
A supermajority.
Exactly.
When half the states don't agree with you.
Exactly. 2/3 minimum, 3/3 of the states ratifying. Impossible to do. The president didn't have the authority, and Abraham Lincoln said, I don't have the authority to get rid of slavery. It's not possible. But by seceding, the southern states now were in rebellion against the United States. And ironically, provided the opportunity for Abraham Lincoln to do by executive order, by order of the president, what he could never have done by constitutional means otherwise. And the key to it, this is a beautiful handout, which I'll post the class webpage if you like, on the Emancipation Proclamation. The key to it was this. That the president of the United States, well, in the Constitution, when the United States is at war, the president is the commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy. He's the commander-in-chief. And thus, any part of the country that it was in, that was in rebellion against the United States, he had the authority as commander-in-chief to impose laws on them because they were no longer protected by the Constitution, in effect. So in 1863, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. And it said, the slaves in any part of the United States that are currently in rebellion against the United States are hereby and forever free. So this was a huge leap forward made possible by the fact that the South had seceded. That was not the only one. And a lot of Americans have the impression that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and that's kind of the end of the story in 1863. But he didn't and could not. And here again is the irony. When he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, he could only do certain things. He could only issue the proclamation having to do with the parts of the United States that were in rebellion. So as a result, any part of the United States that was not in rebellion at the time was still subject to the Constitution, and he couldn't do anything about it. So, not all the slaves were free yet. And the question arises, well, how are they going to be free then? Because the only way to free the slaves is for a part of the country to be in rebellion, then how are they all going to ever be freed? Timothy, you have a guess?
I think I have a guess as to how they could free the other slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think only 4 slave states did not secede.
Mm-hmm.
And, one or 2 options. First of all, the seceded states technically didn't count as part of the United States then, and they just held a supermajority. They just held the change of the Constitution with a supermajority because there was all these free states outnumbering the 4 slave states to change the Constitution to make all states free. Or they had a supermajority after all the states seceded became free, then it would be an absolute supermajority.
You're on the right track. By seceding, these states are no longer participating in the federal government. And so you're right that there's only so many states that have slavery. But even states like Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri, West Virginia, there wasn't a lot of slavery in those states. So they weren't going to vote against the constitutional amendment. So now, during this time, you could get a constitutional amendment to get rid of slavery everywhere. But you have to do it at a certain point, right? In a sense, they had to wait because the question was, are we going to win this war or not? Right? So Abraham Lincoln issued this proclamation in 1863 while the war was still raging, and he could do this as a way of basically punishing the South that was in rebellion. But in order to get a permanent result and in order to permanently eradicate slavery and free the slaves, it had to be that you could get the government together and produce a permanent amendment to the Constitution. So that could only be done after the war was over and the country was somehow reconstituted. You could know that you would produce an amendment. You would get rid of slavery officially and legally, and that would never be reversed. So that's what we're going to see tomorrow, is this phase of history that follows the war. Many, many slaves, most of them had been freed by Emancipation Proclamation, but not all. And there still formally needed to be a repudiation of slavery. And that had to come only after the war was over and by legal means. And we're going to see that, and then we're going to see the country kind of put back together again. How do you rebuild a country that has been at war and that is so deeply divided on an issue like this? The phase of history that follows is called Reconstruction. Basically the story of how the United States was put back together again. Okay, well, it's weighty and it's tragic, but it's a step forward. And we're going to get, as Abraham Lincoln said, a new birth of freedom. All right, we'll pick things up tomorrow and keep going. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.